different countries, particularly Colombia and Brazil. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. We have been at these microphones numerous times to discuss the tragic unraveling of one of Latin America's most prosperous countries, due in large part to the epic mismanagement and corruption, first under the rule of Hugo Chavez and then under his successor in 2013, Nicolas Maduro. Mr. Maduro further centralized power in the executive branch, suppressed dissent through violence and intimidation, and won the loyalty of the military by giving it control of lucrative industries. His re-election in May 2018 to a new six-year term was widely viewed as fraudulent. By the time of his inauguration on January 10, 2019, many countries did not recognize his new term as legitimate, including the United States, Canada, and a dozen Latin American nations. Instead, they recognized Juan Guaido, the 35-year-old leader of the opposition Voluntad Popular, who was the duly elected leader of the National Assembly. He consequently asserted his right, under the Venezuelan constitution, to serve as the interim president of the country until new elections could be held. Since then, Russia, Iran, via its proxy Hezbollah, China, and Cuba have stood by Maduro, while more than 50 countries, including much of Latin America and Europe, have joined the United States to support Guaido. On April 30, 2019, Juan Guaido led a group of several dozen military personnel and civilians in an uprising against Nicolas Maduro as part of what he called Operation Freedom. However, in the end, the uprising faltered, having apparently failed to gain the support of senior members of the Venezuelan military. Nonetheless, two former ranking generals in Venezuela's security services, now in exile, have been speaking out recently about what they see as rampant corruption and pervasive Cuban influence in the government of President Nicolas Maduro. General Manuel Christopher Figueira and retired General Hugo Carvajal have been talking to reporters about their roles in recent attempts to drive Maduro from power. They have also criticized the latest round of EU-backed talks between the Venezuelan government and the opposition, which the EU has launched in Barbados. Venezuela was once one of Latin America's greatest economic success stories. Today, millions of Venezuelans have fled the country, leaving behind a legacy of recent violence in a place of power blackouts, malnutrition, and threats of disease, especially among children and the poor. Neighboring countries such as Brazil and Colombia are grappling with an influx of migrants. Economically, Venezuela is beset by virulent hyperinflation. External debt is spiraling out of control with a deep slump in oil exports because of the dire financial condition of the Venezuelan state-owned oil company, PDVSA. Well, with us for an update on Venezuela are two distinguished regional analysts. Eric Farnsworth is vice president of the Council of the Americas and the Americas Society. That's a leading voice on the Western Hemisphere. And Mark Feirstein, he's a former special assistant to President Barack Obama and senior director for Western Hemisphere Affairs on the National Security Council. Currently, he's senior advisor with the Albright-Stonebridge Group's Latin America practice. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, Eric, you've been at these microphones before. Let me begin with you. Venezuela is obviously still facing a crisis on both the economic and political fronts. Despite this aborted coup attempt in April, we still have two men, Maduro and Guaido, claiming to be legitimate presidents. Talk about where we are in Venezuela currently.
Thanks, Carol. Thanks for having me back. Where we are in Venezuela is a situation that continues to deteriorate, not just in terms of a political and economic crisis, but also a humanitarian crisis. And I want to briefly mention that first, because I think that's what is really driving some of the urgency for political change in Venezuela. We have currently more than 4 million Venezuelans outside the country as refugees. There are estimates that as many as 8 million could be outside the country by 2020. And where are they going to go? To neighbors Colombia, Peru, Brazil, etc. So this is not just a Venezuelan crisis, it is now a regional crisis. That's point number one. Point number two, and you alluded to it in your earlier comments, because of the gross and sustained mismanagement of the Venezuelan economy, the economy has contracted significantly, over 50% already in recent years, and the IMF just came out with projections that would suggest that this year the Venezuelan economy will contract by a further 35%. This is unprecedented in the Western Hemisphere. And to put this in context, Venezuela at one point was the wealthiest nation in Latin America. So to have the once wealthiest nation in the region now become literally an economic basket case is a huge tragedy. It has led to humanitarian crisis that's affecting the entire region. So within that context, the Venezuelan Constitution permits and indeed calls for Mr. Guaido as the leader of the legislature to be acting as the interim president to organize elections, free and fair elections, to replace Mr. Maduro, whose elections, as you mentioned, were fraudulent and not recognized. That's where we are. Neither side is recognizing the other's legitimacy. We have a political stalemate, and that's why the international community in large measure is trying to step in and facilitate a peaceful transition.
We have a political stalemate, Mark Feirstein, driven also by this horrific humanitarian crisis. Please give us your take on where do we go from here.
Yeah, well, I think it is helpful to understand why Nicolas Maduro has been able to hold on. Because if we had sat here, you know, 3 years back, and if we'd been told that inflation would run to 1,000,000%, that the economy would contract by 50%, as Eric has noted, that you'd have 4 million migrants pouring out in less than 2 years, if we were told that you'd have an alternative president that was recognized by 50 countries, including the United States and many others in Latin America and in Europe, and other countries, in addition to the United States, would have applied sanctions, both targeted and more general, we would not have expected Maduro to hold on. That said, he has. And I think there are a few reasons for that. First, of course, he maintains the loyalty of the leadership of the military. Second, you have a population that has been demobilized. And then, of course, you mentioned the roles of Russia and China and Cuba. Russia has provided some key support to Venezuela, basically playing a geopolitical game here. China has provided some key economic support, and Cuba has been very supportive with regard to intelligence and security. So you put all those factors together, Maduro has been able to hold on.
Well, turning to you, Eric, to talk more about the military. And we recently note that a couple of generals who defected and who were involved in this attempted coup are speaking out. But talk about the challenge that remains, because as long as the bulk of the military senior leaders are going to back Maduro, it looks like it's going to be very difficult to dislodge him, notwithstanding all the other support that Guaido has received by the international community.
I think that's quite right, and Mark made a very important point where he talked about the leadership of the military, and the leadership does remain loyal to Maduro by all accounts, not necessarily because they're loyal to him or his person or his ideology, but because they are so fully embedded in the corruption of the regime that Maduro has facilitated and allowed and encouraged, that these senior leaders are fully implicated not just in corruption, but at the same time, they're living lavish lifestyles that there's no way they could live under a democratic government on a government salary. So this is illegal gold mining and selling. It's illegal drug trafficking. It's activities that are just rejected by the international community. And they're fully implicated in that. And in some measure, they really have no choice but to remain loyal to the regime, support the regime, because if the regime goes, their own fortunes are just eliminated. But the key here may not be the leadership. I think it's hard to suggest that the entire military or security forces as an institution would be loyal to the regime. The reason why is because at the lower levels, they don't have access to this gross level of corruption. They have to live in the same economy that every other Venezuelan does. And so when Mr. Guaido tried to call for the overthrow of the regime on April 30th, you did see a number of defections from the lower and mid-levels of the Venezuelan security forces because they're the ones who, frankly, have no benefits from the regime to speak of, and so they have the least to lose. But it is still a very risky game to be playing. The military does maintain the balance of power in the country, and until and unless that particular body begins to at least go from support for Maduro to neutral, the prospects for Mr. Maduro leaving, I think, are not so strong.
So turning back to you, Mark Feirstein, when you look at the two sides and who's supporting whom, it's hard to imagine that those who are supporting Guaido couldn't somehow have more leverage over these senior military leaders. What is it about this standoff on both sides? And should we believe that Russia, China, and Cuba have such a stranglehold that the United States and all these other countries couldn't break?
Well, the administration has tried to put pressure on both civilian and military leaders who back Maduro with the goal of creating fissures within the regime and ideally having someone escort Maduro out of power and out of the country. And we saw that actually almost worked on April 30th. So the United States has applied sanctions on dozens of senior officials. Latin America has been slow to react. Their rhetoric has been very good, but their actions have lagged. It's just not part of the tradition of Latin American countries to be sanctioning their neighbors. But there is an effort now by the United States to encourage the European Union to apply additional sanctions. Of course, the United States also went beyond the targeted sanctions and has applied broader economic sanctions, particularly with regard to the oil sector. You know, the administration's approach to date has basically been to squeeze the regime to put as much pressure as possible. Now we're seeing an additional element, which are the negotiations in Barbados that you mentioned, which the Norwegians are convening. There's a lot of skepticism about those negotiations, which I think is justified, given the fact that dialogue in 2015, 2016, 2017 failed and was in fact counterproductive because the Maduro regime used the talks to buy time and consolidate power. That said, I think there are some important differences now. One is that the situation in Venezuela is that much worse than it was before, just a few years ago. As a result, you have this mobilization of the international community that we've talked about. You have this additional pressure. You have an alternative president there that's been recognized. And you have much more skilled negotiators in the Norwegians than you had a few years back. So I'm not necessarily hopeful that those negotiations will work, but I think most people recognize that some combination of the negotiations and additional pressure on Maduro and people around him are most likely way out of this crisis.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the Americas Society, and Mark Feirstein, from whom you just heard. He's Senior Advisor with the Albright Stonebridge Group's Latin America Practice. I'm Carol Castiel. We're discussing the ongoing political and economic crisis in Venezuela, how it can be brought to an end, as well as its devastating impact on the once prosperous country and the entire continent of Latin America. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener from Brazil, Mauro Fernandes Franco. He's from São Paulo. Muito obrigado, Mauro. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Eric Farnsworth. With regard to these EU-sponsored talks in Barbados with the Norwegians in charge, what is the end game in your view, and do you see them as potentially being successful in helping to break this terrible deadlock?
The end game, hopefully, is free and fair elections that bring to power under the Constitution of Venezuela, a new president. Will these negotiations in Barbados lead to that? I think I share Mark's skepticism because there's a lack of trust, certainly between the Guaido interim government and the Maduro regime. But more to the point, the incentives haven't shifted sufficiently for Mr. Maduro to find it in his self-interest to agree to elections, which if you can believe the polls, he would probably lose under a free and fair scenario. And why have the incentives not shifted? Because he has proven himself willing to sacrifice his country and his people for his own personal and regime ambitions. And to the extent that he doesn't essentially care what happens to the Venezuelan people and is content to allow those folks who can to leave the country as an escape valve and to take the limited resources now available to the regime and dedicate them to the support of his security forces and his regime officials, he can weather for a good long time even very stringent efforts of the international community to begin to force him out. So there has to really be a way to change those incentives, which has not, in my view, occurred yet, despite the very good efforts of many countries. One group of countries we should probably note is the Lima Group, which just met in Argentina, and the rhetoric was very strong, very good, very positive in the context of democratic governance for Venezuela. But again, the actions really have to follow the rhetoric, and there are additional steps that could be taken there. But until those incentives really change, the prospect of successful negotiations, I think, remains remote.
Mark Feirstein, I'd like you to address the role of Cuba, Russia, China once again. Mm-hmm. What would it take for them to sort of turn on Maduro or be mollified by the other side to back off.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. In the case of Russia, they are about to get their debts repaid this summer. So that raises a question, will that then make them more likely or less likely now to work with the United States and others to remove Maduro? China has largely stayed on the sidelines. There is an argument to be made to the Chinese that they would be much better off and their investments would be better protected and certainly more profitable if you had a stable government in place that can manage the economy effectively and advance some sort of social and political stability. And the case of Cuba is a little more complicated because Cuba relies to a great extent now on Venezuelan largesse and subsidized and free oil that they are receiving. That said, there have been discussions between Canada and Cuba, try to get a sense of what it might take for Cuba to play a more responsible role in the context of Venezuela. I think there's a case to be made in Cuba as well, because if Maduro were to fall, Cuba would suffer greatly, and to the extent that they can play some sort of a role in advancing a transition there and maintaining some sort of relationship with some subsequent Venezuelan government, I think that would be in their interest.
I'm sure that Guaido would want to do that.
Guaido is open. Look, Guaido and his people are open, and they have been talking to the Chinese. They've been talking to the Russians. I'm not sure about the nature of their discussions with the Cubans, but they would like to have a channel with the Cubans. I don't believe that that's initially been opened yet. Mm-hmm. But they are willing to work with any international actor that could help advance a democratic transition in Venezuela.
Turning quickly back to you, Eric Farnsworth, to characterize the U.S. role in all of this. U.S. was in the lead. But some are very critical of the U.S. administration's approach. How would you characterize it, and what would you recommend that the Trump administration do to help facilitate this outcome?
It's a super complicated question, and certainly one that many of us have been wrestling with for a long time. And as the situation deteriorates, the question becomes that more urgent, but the solutions don't become any clearer. So that's why it becomes so complicated. You know, I think that the administration has made very clear its desire that Mr. Maduro leave, has fully supported the Guaido interim government, and has taken steps, as we've talked about, to try to facilitate that. But there is also a very real sense that the United States cannot do this by itself in a unilateral way. I mean, it has the capability to do it, but it wouldn't necessarily be the wise step. And I think senior U.S. officials acknowledge that. And it's why, in some cases, they've actually been quite reserved in the steps that have been taken. Having said that, at times rhetoric has gotten ahead of reality and perhaps raised expectations, particularly among Venezuelans, of some sort of an armed intervention, which I don't see in the cards anytime soon. And so, you know, there's some difference of opinion in terms of whether that's the best course to take. But having said that, a steady approach with regional allies who are the most directly affected, I think, over time, has the best chance for success in Venezuela. But success is not guaranteed. It requires a sustained approach, and it frankly requires a real willingness to work with allies in a way that perhaps politically hasn't been possible in the past.
Willingness to work with allies is certainly not the way one would describe the current Trump administration. So back to you, Mark, for your take.
Yeah, sure. Look, I think all of us who have worked on Venezuela need to approach this with a great deal of humility. We've all tried various things there, and frankly, none have worked. The situation is worse there now than it's ever been. You know, I spent 2 years at the National Security Council, last 2 years the Obama administration, spent more time on a sustained basis on Venezuela than any other issue, had more requests from President Obama for memos on Venezuela than any other country, and obviously left frustrated, and I imagine my successors continue to feel frustrated by the lack of success there. I think it is important to note that there is a strong bipartisan support for the approach the administration is currently taking, or most elements of what the administration is doing. There is strong support for the targeted sanctions. There is some disagreement about the exact mix of economic sanctions that should be applied. I think there is largely agreement between the administration, Democrats, and many Republicans that, as Eric said, a military option would not be wise, and frankly, I don't think is on the table in any way. But you know, I think the approach that's being taken now, which is try to ratchet up as much pressure as possible on the regime, but to do so in a way that does not also hurt the Venezuelan people, and that's tricky with, you know, with the sanctions that go beyond the targeted ones, that combined with the negotiations led by the Norwegians probably provides the best hope for a solution. Now, again, you know, is that likely? Perhaps not. And again, as I noted in the beginning, it's remarkable that Maduro has held on as long as he has, and one would hope that we'd see a resolution this year, but I don't know if we can be optimistic about that given recent history.
Well, as we close, Eric Farnsworth, let's talk about this crisis in the context of the continent, because you said it's not just for Venezuelans a tragedy, but the entire continent is suffering because of the migration of Venezuelans to Colombia, to Brazil. So this is a huge crisis. If we don't deal with it, we're not talking about just one country, but an entire continent. Discuss the impact of the migration, especially on Brazil and Colombia and other neighboring countries.
Well, the impact is massive, and it's getting more massive by the day, literally. You know, the Colombians have been, in my view, very welcoming to Venezuelans. There's a long history, in fact, of Colombians seeking refuge over the years in Venezuela. So there is a real fluid border between the two countries, and even in the best of circumstances. And so the Colombians have welcomed, to the extent possible, Venezuelans coming across the border and have tried to absorb and accommodate as many as possible. But at some point, you reach a limit of your ability to absorb folks from a country that's not your own, and Colombia is clearly reaching those limits, particularly in the context of its own complicated domestic politics. So you do have a real budget issue here that the Colombians are struggling with. Perhaps their situation is most acute, but Peru, Ecuador, even Chile, Brazil you mentioned, and let's not forget the islands of the Caribbean, because you have a number of Venezuelan boat people now seeking refuge in Curacao, Aruba, and some of the islands. If we think Colombia doesn't have the capacity to address these refugees, certainly small islands in the Caribbean don't either.
Is the international community or the United Nations helping these countries?
There's a lot of rhetorical support, but the actual amount of money that's been delivered is scant, well below what's been promised and well below what would be required.
So, Mark, really this illustrates the urgency of dealing with this crisis, because we're not talking just about Venezuela and the Venezuelan people, but all the neighboring countries. So, once again, what is your take on the impact on the continent?
Well, if I could actually speak to that migration point, which I think is important and has lessons for the United States as well. It is remarkable how welcoming many of the countries have been, and they've provided work permits and provided other provisions to allow them to incorporate to the extent possible into society there and be productive members. You contrast that with, you know, frankly, the bigotry and the racism that you hear from leadership of our own government and making it more difficult for people, wherever they're from, to apply for asylum. So I think there's a real lesson for the United States here, and we should be taking the lead. Not only should we be supporting the Colombians and Peruvians and others to the extent possible with assistance so they can take care of the refugees, we also be looking at the policies they've adopted and the rhetoric they've adopted, and we should try to mimic them to the extent possible as well.
Well, that's an interesting point on which to conclude, and we'll have to talk about that in another program. But some would say that the very people in the administration that are promoting a transition to Guaido are perhaps the very people who might be skeptical about providing foreign assistance to Venezuela and Latin America. What do you say to that, Eric?
Well, it does seem to be a challenge from certainly two sides of the House. That's exactly right. And we could also note the recent effort in the U.S. Congress to provide temporary protective status, or TPS, to Venezuelans in the United States, which was recently defeated, might come up again in a few days. But there is a real challenge here, because the need to help address the crisis in Venezuela does seem to be running cross-current with some of the political currents in the United States on immigration and on foreign assistance.
Exactly. So we can't really disassociate these kinds of issues, right, Mark Feirstein? These apparent contradictions need to be reconciled.
Yes, absolutely. The point you made is key. On the one hand, we have an administration that's trying to encourage other countries to absorb refugees, to take tough measures with regard to Venezuela, but we're not prepared to provide the assistance. And in fact, on the contrary, we're withdrawing assistance from the region. There are clear contradictions in the administration's approach here.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Americas Society and Council of the Americas, and Mark Feirstein, Senior Advisor with the Albright Stonebridge Group's Latin America Practice. Thanks to both of you. Gracias for coming in and sharing your insights.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guests. Our engineer was Bill Andrade. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for an analysis of former special counsel Robert Mueller's testimony before Congress about his report on Russia's interference in the 2016 election. That's next week on Encounter on The Voice of America.
silver feather, you and me. We'll change the weather, yeah. We'll be the heat in December when you found me. I've been dancing on top of cars and stumbling out of bars. I follow you through the dark, can't get enough. You're the medicine and the pain, the tattoo inside my brain. And baby, you know it's obvious. I'm a sucker for